Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for September 9, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Got two guests up tonight. In about 5 minutes or so, we'll be speaking with Anatole Levin of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace about what's going on in Chechnya and the school hostage outrage in Beslan in Russia, and related matters. And then at the little after 5:30, we'll speak with Sylvia Allegretto, who is with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and is one of the three authors of this year's edition of The State of Working America. And every other year, they release a preliminary version of the book around Labor Day and then a full published book of which incorporates some of the income and poverty numbers and such, which were released a few weeks ago. That will be published in January by Cornell University Press. But we'll talk with Sylvia Allegretto about the state of working America, which, as you might imagine, isn't so great. And before we get to Anatole Levin, just a few words on some of the economic headlines. The weekly total of jobless claims, that is the number of people who've just lost their jobs, who head over to the unemployment office to sign up for benefits, that fell by a very large 44,000 last week. Some of this may be due to bad weather ahead of the Labor Day holiday, so I'm not sure how seriously to take this number. But it had been stuck around 340,000, which is not a bad level, but also not a great level either. It's now down around 320,000, which signifies at least some improvement in the job market. But we'll see whether this is a statistical quirk or actually some sign of lasting improvement. The weekly ABC Money magazine poll of consumer attitudes in the United States ticked up by 4 points last week. It's on a scale of minus 100 to plus 100. It's now at minus 7, which is actually a little above its long-term average since the series began in 1985. It took a slide from August into September, but now has bounced up. But this is mostly because of improvements among self-identified Republicans. The gap between Republicans and Democrats is unusually wide. I've looked at the history going back to 1990, and we're at near record levels in the gap between the perceptions of Republicans, who are much more optimistic than Democrats. The gap is about 70 or 80 points. The normal figure is less than half that. And that's unusual in that the gaps between richer and poorer people, which are normally fairly wide, as you might imagine, richer people generally more optimistic about the economy than poorer people. Those gaps are in a fairly normal range, but the partisan gap is very, very wide, and it does seem to be affecting consumer attitudes and possibly consumer behavior. So we'll see what that looks like going forward. Also, Americans borrowing a lot again. The Federal Reserve's tally of consumer credit for July rose at a 9.4% annual rate. That is charge cards, credit cards, credit for things like autos, which are computed separately, rose at a 5% annual rate. Both those are pretty healthy rates of growth. But what really has been happening over the last year or so is that people have been continuing to borrow money against the value of their housing. That has been rising at an 8% annual rate, nearly twice the rate of increase in incomes. So and in some cases, people are using the house housing credit as a substitute for credit cards. But now they also seem to be deploying the credit cards again as well. And people always get worried about consumer debt, and it's certainly something to be concerned about. But it's been increasing for a long, long time, since consumer credit started in the 1920s. And people periodically get worried that this is going to cause some sort of economic cataclysm, but it hasn't arrived yet. At some point it may, but Americans keep borrowing, and the wheel of consumption keeps turning, and Well, we haven't had any kind of crunch yet in that world. It may happen, but the worrywarts who've been worrying for at least 30 years have consistently been proved wrong in their worries. But maybe the Chicken Littles will be right someday, but not yet. And the Federal Reserve Board, in its so-called Beige Book, it's a survey of the U.S. economy, which comes out every 6 weeks or so, which is just issued just before the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meets to set interest rate policy. That's reporting continued economic expansion, although at a fairly moderate pace. Some signs of slowdown in the consumer side. They report manufacturing still strong. And they also say wage increases modest. The labor market still expanding, but not very not at a terribly rapid pace. They do notice that wage pressures are building for skilled workers, but not for less skilled workers. So this does seem to be a very bifurcated economy, with people at the top doing considerably better than everyone else. And also a number of employers, businesses raising concerns about rising health care premiums. And along those lines, the Kaiser Family Foundation released a survey today showing that health insurance premiums have been rising at a rate about five times as fast as wages, up 11% this year. A little slower than last year's 14%, but still a very rapid pace. And the number of people, covered on the job with health insurance continues to fall. So as recently as 2001, 65% of all workers had health insurance from their employers. That's now down to 61%, which translates into roughly 5 million fewer workers with health insurance on the job. So I think we'll talk to Sylvia Allegretto of EPI about that a little later. But it is a very serious problem that has not yet matured into the kind of political issue that it might. And now we're joined on the line by Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and author of a book came out several years ago about Chechnya and Russian power, and also author of a forthcoming book, America, Right or Wrong, which will be coming out, I believe, in next month from Oxford University Press. Welcome to WBI, Anatole Levin.
Hello.
So what was your book on Chechnya called?
It was called Chechnya, Tombstone of Russian Power. You see, I covered Chechnya for the London Times as a correspondent based in the former Soviet Union and Russia from 1992 to 1996, and the book was ultimately based upon my own observations of Chechnya before and during the First Chechen War.
Okay, so what do you make of the latest news of crisis, a horrifying school seizure? Who do you think was behind that hostage crisis?
Well, it's very clear that it was radical Chechen separatist rebels, probably led by the most famous Chechen commander, Shamil Basayev, and closely allied with international radical Islamist groups. Not necessarily Al-Qaeda itself directly, but the same, for example, financing groups which support Al-Qaeda. Indeed, this has been established by American intelligence.
Now, of course, a lot of Russians think that American intelligence is behind these people. What do you think of those ideas?
Oh, I don't. I mean, only a very small number of insane Russian chauvinists think that American intelligence is actually helping the Chechen terrorists. A much larger number, of course, including President Putin himself, think that if not the American government, then certainly American society ought to be expressing more sympathy for Russia and doing more to help Russia.
On the other hand, we see a lot of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration actually not being very sympathetic to Russia. And it's kind of funny to see them urging political solutions and negotiations, these people who see nothing but the barrel of a gun as the proper approach to Islamic radicals elsewhere think that there should be negotiations in Chechnya. What do you make of that strange alliance? Richard Pipes, for example, has a piece in today's New York Times, which was urging negotiation and rather than military solution.
Well, surely we no longer expect moral consistency or decency from these people, do we?
No.
you know, given their radically different attitudes over the years, you know, to democracy in some countries and in others, to human rights in some countries and in others, to international law concerning some countries and others, I'm hardly surprised that they have, you know, very different attitudes to Russia and to Israel or India, say. That is not, by the way, to say that the call for negotiations is in itself wrong. As long as one is clear who the Russians should negotiate with and on what basis. I mean, to call for the Russians to negotiate with the terrorists who committed this atrocity in Beslan and who have committed similar atrocities in recent months and years, that would be truly monstrous. That would be utterly disgraceful given America's stand on similar issues elsewhere. The question is whether there are more moderate Chechen separatists with whom the Russians can negotiate some kind of deal. But as I argued in a recent op-ed, we have to be also very clear that that deal would not end the war any more than a deal with relatively moderate Kashmiris or Palestinians would completely end the conflicts there. It would merely undercut support for the terrorists and hopefully create a broader coalition to fight them.
Well, what is the relation between the gang who took over that school and the broader Chechen population? How deep is the support? Are they off in their own off their own frolic?
Well, the only actual vote which gives one any kind of sense of numbers was the Chechen presidential election of February 1997, after Russia withdrew from Chechnya at the end of the First Chechen War. Now, in that vote, 65% of the Chechen population voted for General Aslan Maskhadov, who became president. And he stood on a platform of independence, but also of ending the conflict with Russia and of creating a modern Chechen state, so on a moderate platform. And two-thirds of the Chechen population voted for him. Only, I think it was 21% voted at that time for Shamil Basayev, who represented the much more radical nationalist and the much more radical Islamist version, and who really, as it turned out, wanted to continue the war against Russia until, as he saw it, the whole of the Caucasus was liberated and also Islamized. And then other more radical figures swept up most of the rest. But one can certainly say, and this has been my own observation over the years, that most of the Chechen population, more than two-thirds, really, they want, above all, peace. They want to get the Russian armed forces out of Chechnya and put an end to their atrocities. But they do not support either the radical nationalist or the radical Islamist program. Unfortunately, however, as we've seen, you know, in many other conflicts of this kind, you don't have to have a majority on your side. You only have to have a sufficiently radicalized, brutalized, and infuriated minority. And that the Chechen radicals certainly do have. They also, of course, do have considerable funding from radical groups in the Middle East.
And where's that funding come from?
Well, according to U.S. intelligence, among the groups who have financed the Chechens has been a group called Al-Karamein, which is Egyptian-based, if I remember rightly, but largely Saudi-funded, and which has also funded Al-Qaeda and similar groups in other parts of the Muslim world. In the year 2000, Al-Qaeda itself did actually announce that it was sending volunteers, money, and arms to Chechnya. But whether it did that directly or whether it only encouraged certain allies to do so is not clear. But Shamil Basayev was in Afghanistan several times in the late 1990s for training and to gather support. And so the link with Al-Qaeda has been definitely established.
And how much of this is blowback from the U.S.-sponsored war against the Soviets in Afghanistan? Is there any traces of that?
Well, insofar as that war, of course, you know, really created the basis for Al-Qaeda by creating these masses of Arab fighters in Afghanistan and funding them and creating the international networks which supported them, then yes. And ever since then, Afghan veterans, I mean, Arab and other Muslim veterans of the Afghan war, have, of course, been cropping up all over the place, wherever one sees Islamist terrorism and radicalism, from North Africa, you know, all the way across to Indonesia and the southern Philippines. So, yes, ultimately there is a link, but it's an indirect one. I don't think it would be fair to attribute, you know, directly any responsibility of America for what's now happening in Chechnya.
Let's go back in history a bit. How did Chechnya end up as part of Russia in the first place?
Well, it was conquered in the 19th century, you know, very much as part of the same process which led to the British conquering India and the French conquering North Africa. And dare I say it, I mean, the United States conquering the American West. You know, all these imperial nations conquered smaller and more less developed peoples and incorporated them in the empire. And of course, you know, in many parts of the world, those peoples fought back ever since to get their independence. That is the root of it. In the Chechen case, a particularly evil twist was given to Chechen suffering and consequent resentment by the fact that in 1944, Stalin reacted to a Chechen rebellion by accusing the Chechens of collaborating with the Nazis and deporting the whole nation in horrible circumstances to Central Asia, where many of them died. And they weren't allowed back till 1957. Of course, he did that to a number of different nations. But whether because the Chechens suffered more or because they have, for a long time, had a more radical version of Islam, the Chechens seem to have taken this horrible experience more to heart, and it's given many Chechens, even before the Russian invasion of 1994, a strong desire for revenge against Russia.
I was speaking with Anatole Levin of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. What is the Russian interest in holding on to Chechnya? Are they afraid of a kind of South Carolina secession precedent, or is it what is their interest?
There are a number of different things. Yes, I mean, they oppose secession. Putin has said again and again that, you know, he, as elected president of Russia, it is his duty to maintain Russian territorial integrity. In this, of course, one must say that Russia is simply following the norm. I mean, a majority of Kashmiris want independence from India. India is, of course, a much more genuinely democratic state than Russia, but India has never agreed to this and never will, in my view, and has also used extremely brutal means to suppress this Kashmiri separatist movement. So territorial integrity is one part, and the fear that if Chechnya goes, others will follow. Another thing, however, that one must remember is that in 1996, having suffered very badly in the First Chechen War, Russia did really leave Chechnya completely and gave it de facto independence. And for a whole set of reasons, the result was really disastrous. Maskhadov was elected president with a really solid mandate, as I said, but he totally failed to establish his authority or any kind of basis for statehood. And Chechnya became a source of really monstrous criminality, kidnapping, murder, directed into adjacent Russian territory. And, of course, a considerable number of Westerners also fell victim to that. And it also became a base for these international Islamist extremists, headed by an Arab called Khattab, who came to Chechnya after 1994 to fight in the First War, and then really set about colonizing the place to turn it into a base for jihad to drive Russia out of the entire North Caucasus and unite the area with Chechnya in one Islamic Republic. They declared this perfectly openly. And in alliance with Basayev and other Chechen radical commanders, they actually tried to put this into effect in 1999 by invading the neighboring Republic of Dagestan. So Russians are afraid that if they let Chechnya go, that will not be the end of the war, that many Chechens will continue the war. This, you know, is very much what even some moderate Israelis fear. That, you know, if you let the Palestinian territories go, you will have radical Palestinian groups based in those territories who will continue to fight for the destruction of Israel. So this is a second and very important motive. And that, of course, I think, does create the responsibility of people who, you know, advocate a peace settlement in Chechnya, to state clearly, you know, how they would prevent that happening, because between 96 and 99, the elected Chechen government completely failed to prevent that happening.
And there was also a period of Sharia in Chechnya, wasn't there?
Well, yes. Maskhadov reacted to this pressure from the radical commanders and the Islamists by himself becoming more and more Islamic. And yes, he declared Sharia was the law of Chechnya. There were public executions and floggings. But in my experience of Maskhadov, who, like his predecessor, Dudayev, was a former Soviet officer, how sincere he was in this, I would rather doubt. I think he was really doing it in an effort to undercut the radicals, an effort which failed, by the way.
How valid do you think the demands for independence are from the Chechens? What kind of future would independence mean?
In the long run, and by long run, I mean, you know, after decades, perhaps, obviously Chechnya's calls for independence are valid. Chechnya has suffered terribly under Russian rule. Russian forces have committed numerous atrocities. In the short term, short to medium term, I don't think they're valid at all because of this horrible experience when Chechnya was independent in 96 to 99. And as I say, I mean, Chechnya was not just a menace to Russia, but it was a menace to the West. Westerners were kidnapped and murdered. Ferociously anti-Western Islamist extremists allied with Al-Qaeda based themselves there. And in my view, before Chechnya can be independent, it's quite obvious that there has to be a long, long period of building a modern Chechen society, building Chechen political institutions. I mean, one thing, you know, by comparison with Palestine, say, that the Chechens have never even had a modern nationalist movement or a military political organization. You know, they've just had bands of fighters led by warlords. They can't be given independence in those circumstances. So really, they have to... I would say that responsible Chechens and responsible Westerners should accept enhanced autonomy within the Russian Federation in return for a whole set of Russian concessions and guarantees, which in turn would have to be guaranteed and backed up by the West.
Now, Russian performance, though, in Chechnya has been characterized by a lot of brutality and incompetence and corruption, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. In the First War and still more in the Second War, the Russian armed forces and intelligence services are really rotten. I mean, rotten almost beyond description. They're incompetent, they're chaotic, they're savagely brutal. It must be said they're savagely brutal very often to their own soldiers. That's one reason why they're so brutal to civilians, because, of course, soldiers who are treated in this way by their own comrades and officers and NCOs take it out on the civilian population. And, of course, their complete incapacity either to treat the Chechen population decently or to, you know, cooperate successfully among themselves has, you know, it's resulted in disaster after disaster.
What are the prospects for a broader ethnic violence in the region? It seems like a tinderbox in some accounts.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that this particular attack, whose victims, you know, most of them were not ethnic Russians, they were ethnic Ossetes, another North Caucasian people, but who generally, you know, allied with Russia over the centuries. And the attackers, it seems, many of them were not Chechens, but yet another Caucasian people. It gets terribly complicated, you know, the Ingush, who have an old feud with the Ossetes and are not as radical as the Chechens, but are ethnically related to the Chechens. The Ossetes and the Ingush had this small but nasty ethnic conflict in 1992, and it looks very much as if this attack was intended to try to reignite that. And on the other side of Chechnya, you have Dagestan, which has 32 different nationalities, many of them with, you know, long-standing land claims against each other. And if you could ignite the conflict in Dagestan and Ingushetia along with Chechnya, then I think at some point in future, probably a long way down the line, but still, you might actually get many Russians saying, look, we've just got to repeat 96, we've got to pull out of the entire region. But you know, that would not be a solution. I mean, that would simply leave really another anarchy, I mean, a Lebanese-style horror, which would once again undoubtedly be colonized by international radical Islamists and terrorists. And we've seen that they have already used areas around Chechnya, like the Pankizi Gorge in Georgia, where there are many Chechen refugees, as a base for planning terrorist attacks against the West. The people who last year planned to carry out a ricin poison attack on London, where it seems several of them originally based in the Pankizi, as Arab extremists, but harbored by Chechen radicals. So this is a prospect which the West would have to be deeply concerned about as well.
So we've only got a minute left, but is there any way out of this mess?
Well, I would say that the West should put great pressure both on Russia and on Maskhadov's people to negotiate a return to full Chechen autonomy under Russian rule, and should back that with a massive aid package. And of course, Russia has to limit atrocities by Russian forces, punish those responsible, as part of the whole process of reforming its own armed forces. Because unless Russia goes for really transparent, thoroughgoing reform in this sector and in other sectors, it can never have any hope of success in Chechnya.
And do you think the Bush administration is up to this task?
I think the Bush administration is too distracted. I mean, it's not up to the task of you know, trying to bring peace between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. It's neglected that issue completely. It's neglecting a host of other vital issues around the world because of its domestic concerns, obviously re-election, and its catastrophic decision to go into Iraq. So no, I don't think the Bush administration is up to it.
Well, thanks for joining us, Anatole Lieben. Anatole Lieben is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington and author of a forthcoming book, America Right or Wrong, and I hope we'll get you back to talk about that in a month or so.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And let's take a little break.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. My mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my, oh my God, oh my God.
And we're back here in Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood going into the second half of the show. And before we do, let's take a little musical break and listen to Alistair Hewlett in a more hopeful song than what we just heard from Anatole Lieben.
No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action, they'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, they soon shall hear the bullets flying. We'll shoot the generals on our own side. Us our comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. Us our comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
And that was a bit of Alistair Hewlett's splendid version of the Internationale. And nice to evoke internationalist spirit after listening to an accounting of inter-ethnic violence in the North Caucasus. Now we are joined on the line by Sylvia Allegretta, who is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and one of the three authors, along with Jared Bernstein and Lawrence Michel, of their biannual State of Working America. Welcome to WBAI, Sylvia.
Yes, nice to be here.
So, the State of Working America, not so great in 2004, is it?
Well, I think it kind of the old answer that all economists always give, and that's it depends. But as far as for most workers, the labor market has a lot of slack in it right now. The jobless recovery and the subsequent weak recovery that's been going on for almost 3 years now since the 2001 recession, there's a lot of labor slack, and it's really hurting workers, and it's hard for those who are unemployed to get work. Those who get work often get part-time work instead of full-time work, or temporary work instead of permanent jobs. And it's trying for a lot of people that are out of work or not working in jobs that they would like to be in.
And just looking at the unemployment rate and other measures, the recession, which mm-hmm. is now over, more than 2 years ago,
right.
almost 3 years ago,
right.
Looked mild, but the recovery has been fairly hellish. But are those numbers deceptive? Was it as mild as it seems on the surface?
Well, it was in terms of most of the post-war recessions. What we could, if you're talking about, kind of the depth of the recession, the actual recession, it was a lot milder. So it wasn't quite as deep, but it now has been so prolonged. Just to give you some context, in most of the previous recessions since the war, excluding 1990, because 1990 was also a jobless recovery. I'll talk about that in a second. But the average for all other recessions to kind of recoup peak-level jobs, that's what a recovery does. It recoups the jobs that you lost during the recession. It, on average, took about 20 months. In the 1990 recession, which was also a very, what they would term not only jobless, but a shallow recession in historical standards, it took about 30 months to recoup those jobs from peak-level employment. In the 2001 recession, we are now 41 months out from peak-level employment, which was March of 2001, the beginning of the recession, and we are still approximately a million jobs short of recouping that peak-level employment. So it gives you a little bit of context of how this one has really struggled for a very long time.
So what's going on? Why do you think this is happening?
Well, we think a couple of things are maybe going on. There's certainly a lot at work at any point in the economy. Sometimes it's hard to pinpoint what exactly is going on. But we do think one of the things that may be going on is that companies now are really squeezing for profits. Even during downturns, they demand profits. We don't know if it's coming from corporate heads or from stockholders or whatever, but we're seeing that businesses are squeezing whatever they can out of the labor that they already have, for instance, by increasing overtime hours. And we're seeing that they are, in fact, using what we call just-in-time employment practices, which are the higher use of overtime from existing workers, increased part-time employment, increased temporary employment. This makes it easier for employees to adjust their labor force the way that they traditionally adjust inventory. And so it really precludes the hiring of full-time permanent workers in place for these workers that are easier to shed when you don't need them and easy to gain when you do. And furthermore, the hiring of these the use of these just-in-time employment practices also circumvents some of the fixed costs, such as the rising health care costs associated with hiring full-time permanent workers. So there could be a couple of things happening. Profits could be one. We see the profits are up. Productivity is also up, but we don't see the excess productivity going to wages. It's mostly going to profits at this time. So middle-income and working-class families have really suffered over the last couple of years. And in terms of real wages, they're barely keeping up with and, in fact, starting to fall behind inflation. So we have a real jobs problem.
And you mentioned productivity, and that gets into a complicated subject. But in the late mm-hmm. 90s, we heard a lot about the productivity revolution, mm-hmm. and it actually continued through the recession and into this strange recovery we've been in for the last couple of years. Now, productivity over the long term, the amount of whatever that a worker can produce in an hour of labor is, you know, the ultimate determinant of living standards.
Absolutely.
It also depends upon how the productivity gains are distributed. So could you unpack some of that for us?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, as economists, we really like to see productivity because, as you mentioned, referring to are the tight labor markets where we had low unemployment, we had high productivity, we had a broad-based gains in the economy at every level, even uneducated or white collar, blue collar, everybody was kind of enjoying a step up due to the increased productivity in the tight labor market of the late 1990s. We're seeing now that we don't have a tight labor market. And in fact, the 5.4% unemployment that we have right now is probably not indicative of how tight the labor market is, unless you kind of keep in mind that we had 4% unemployment in 2000. But as far as
a lot of people have also dropped out of the labor force.
Yeah, we have a couple of things going on, and that's one of the reasons why the unemployment rate might belie the actual difficulties in the labor market right now. And we do see that month after month, the labor force participation rate falls, and if you're not participating, if you're not actively looking for a job, you're not included in the unemployment statistics. And we're seeing that the labor force participation rates have been coming down because of discouraged workers. People just can't find jobs. It's gone on too long. They give up. Probably a better measure is the underemployment rate. And the underemployment rate does capture other types of underutilized labor, such as people who I mentioned earlier who are working part-time, who would really like to be working full-time, but economic conditions aren't beneficial where they're out there finding those full-time jobs that they want. And so we can look at the underemployment rate, which was, to give you a little context, 7.3% at the beginning of the recession. It was 9.4% at the beginning of the recovery, which are back in 2001. And today it's 9.5%. So these, even though unemployment...
So it's worse than it was when the recovery started.
Absolutely. And it hasn't moved at all. And even though unemployment it actually did come down, not theoretically, but it actually did come down. But it came down for, really due to people leaving the labor force, not because people are finding jobs. And we see that in the job numbers. That, we've been creating jobs for about a year now, which is the good news, because we were losing jobs for 2.5 years. We finally started to create jobs about a year ago, but on average, we've only been creating about 140,000 new jobs a month for the past year. And we know that we need about 150,000 on average just to keep up with new entrants into the labor force, and also re-entrants into the labor force, because as we just said, labor force participation fell, and at some point, those people will re-enter the labor force.
I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretta, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, and one of the authors of their biannual State of Working America, which was released in a preliminary version on Labor Day and will be released as a full-fledged book in January by Cornell University Press. Let's talk a bit more about those new jobs. I quoted a Kaiser study at the top of the show showing disappearance of health insurance for a lot of workers and very rapidly rising health insurance premiums. Not rising as rapidly as last year, but still over 11% annual rate, which is very, very hefty.
Really?
What kind of jobs are we creating?
Well, we see that with new numbers that health employer-provided health care is down. There are 45 million people, workers without health insurance. Pension coverage is continually falling. And the new jobs that are being created, and this is basically we look at the share of expanding jobs versus the share of contracting jobs, the share of total employment. And we see, in general, we see the case that the jobs that are being created don't pay as well. They're less likely to come with health care and pension coverage. So we think that the quality of jobs are worse than the jobs that we're losing.
And, of course, manufacturing had, 43 consecutive month decline in employment. So
they've recently come out of that, but I think it was 42 or 43 consecutive months of job loss. So that's a huge impact on our working class here.
And, of course, those are jobs that are often union and come with benefits and replaced by jobs that are non-union and don't come with benefits.
More or less, yes.
That's,
I would say.
Perhaps overly broad strokes, but...
But I think that's a fair assessment.
But now, a lot of people blame offshoring or outsourcing for the problem. How important do you think that is?
Well, we think that right now it's really hard to pin down those numbers. We don't have a good, nice government survey that's picking up jobs that are being outsourced or picking up new jobs that are being created, that are outsourced from the get-go. So new job creations that are outsourced. It's kind of hard to pinpoint those numbers. But certainly we know this is happening. And I think the kind of the potential for this to increase is huge. And I guess actually it's not even a potential. We know this is going to really take off. And there's been a huge kind of supply shock of educated labor in places like India, and with the opening up of the borders and them joining the world economy, this is going to be a big challenge for our policymakers and our economy to deal with this. We've been dealing with it with blue collar and manufacturing work for quite some time now. I think the news here is that we're seeing that the rates of unemployment, for instance, in this last recession, were much broader. The increases were much broader across educational lines. We're seeing that white-collar workers, certainly due to some of the outsourcing, are going to be hurt by this downturn and have been hurt by this downturn and this weak recovery.
And, of course, a couple of weeks ago, the Census Bureau released its annual income and poverty numbers for 2003. How do those look to you?
Well, for the third year in a row, and due to, certainly to some of the problems we've already discussed, it's not a separate issue that the poverty rate increased from 12.1% to 12.5% last year. And we've looked at the middle-income families, so we do it by quartiles and look at the middle quartile, the middle fifth, looking at middle-income families. And between 2000 and 2003, we know that in real terms, meaning after taking inflation into account, their annual incomes fell by $1,500. So people have, this is starting to be a real, this weak recovery and this jobless recovery and the length of this struggling job market is definitely taking its toll on working class families and people who don't, who are really at the bottom of the income scale that have now fallen into poverty.
And you've got a chapter in State of Working America on wealth. We had a great bull market in stocks for most of the 80s and most of the 90s. How broadly spread were those gains?
Well, the problem with wealth, I guess it depends on who you talk to, but
most of us don't have enough of it.
Wealth is, for the amount of wealth we have a lot, but it's very unequally distributed, more so than even income in the United States. And most people think that after the boom of the 90s, they thought, oh, everybody's in the stock market. Everybody's out there buying stock, investing in stocks. And the fact is about half of Americans don't own any stock at all. So the ups and downs of the stock market don't have a lot of, have impact on a lot of people. And certainly for a few people have very large impacts. And unfortunately, we saw that for some working people who had their, pensions and stuff in Enron, they definitely did get hurt. But about half people don't own any stock at all, and only about 40% of those who hold over $5,000 or more. So while, it is a big issue, an important issue, I think for mainstream America, it's not quite as big as maybe a common, thought would have you believe. And remember, the top 1% of wealth holders in this country own over 30% of all wealth. And the bottom 80% of wealth holders own less than 20% of all wealth. So those are the unequal numbers that I'm kind of referring to.
And the racial gaps in wealth are truly enormous, aren't they?
Yeah, there's definitely differences in the holdings and the participation in stock ownership across the racial lines. And again, I mean, there's some improvement. Certainly we have more people at all levels participating, but it's still a minority of people.
And what about racial and gender gaps in wages and incomes? What's been happening to them in recent years?
Well, during the tight labor market of the 1990s, which you referred to earlier, is a good case because that's where we had low unemployment. As I said, we had tight labor markets. The double-digit male African-American male unemployment rate fell below double digits during that time. It has since risen above into double digits once again. But we see that there were a lot of strides made in wages, especially for the bottom wage earners. They really the tight labor markets really put pressure on to increase wages. It brought a lot of people back into the labor force and the workforce, especially minority workers. We saw that type of economy really benefited a broad spectrum, of workers and owners, and everybody was sharing in kind of the broad-based wealth. We've seen a lot of that now has been stalled or actually reversed in the last few years. The example I just gave you, the unemployment rate, is telling. And a lot of this has to do with what you kind of hit on profits earlier. And we're seeing that that normally in a recovery, 80% of the increase in productivity goes to wages, and 21% goes to profits. Today, we're seeing a huge increase in productivity, and those benefits have to go somewhere. But 85% are going to profits, and only 15% to wages. So we're not seeing the recovery that we saw in the 1990s when it was broad-based and everybody enjoyed a higher standing of living and increased standard of living. There are a lot of people in this labor market that are being left behind, and we're, quite frankly, I think, like we mentioned in the book, probably at a crossroads, and we're wondering, are we going to head into a recovery when this economy finally gets its legs, which I don't think it has, by the new numbers, by the kind of steady. I mean, we need job growth in the 300 to thousands range, not 144 like last month. But when we get that, are we going to head into a period of like I just described in the late 1990s, or are we going to head into a period of more like the mid 80s when we had unequal growth, we had increases in poverty, we had increases and decreases in wage growth for the bottom half of the wage scale, and that type of more unbalanced recovery?
Well, maybe this is what George Bush means by the ownership society. It's the owners get all the gains.
Well, that's one of the things that we tried to hit on, is that the ownership society, there are a lot of people in this society who are not participants. And we have to be concerned about those people, too. I mean, we definitely have, as he has mentioned, I believe in his administration, that we have home ownership at record levels, and that's certainly due to the policy of very, very, very low interest rates, and that's a very good thing. But we're definitely seeing, we still see that African Americans, for instance, less than 50% are homeowners. So there's still a lot of room for improvement, a lot of room for growth.
I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and one of the three authors of The State of Working America. And policy is in your institute's name. So let's talk about the Bush administration's policies. What have their economic policies been, and what have their contributions been to the state we're in?
Well, I think one of the biggest things was the tax cuts. The tax cuts were sold as a job stimulus package. That was their terminology. That's how they sold the tax cuts. And we certainly see that the jobs have not even recovered the level of jobs that we were at in March of 2001. So the jobs have not come anywhere near close to what the administration said that they would, that this tax stimulus would create. So job creation has not happened on their watch.
They promised, what, 3 million jobs out of their tax cut?
They promised something like 5.5 million jobs by the end of this year. And
they got a ways to go.
Yeah, and that would have meant something like 300 and some thousand jobs per month. Like I said, we're way, way below that. And, this administration is going to be the first administration since Hoover to not create one net job in their four-year term. It's going to be close to impossible for them to meet that because they're about a million jobs short right now and time's running out. So we definitely think that this poorly targeted stimulus was a huge problem. But right now, you know, Congress has pretty much played out and emptied the piggy bank on that stimulus. And so unless we're willing to go further into debt and have like a jobs program and having tax cuts that go to the middle class that will be spent, and we know there's a multiplier effect for the people in the middle class who need this money and who go out and spend this money right away to pay for their basic needs, unless we're willing to go further into debt, we're probably going to have to muddle through this until the growing economy absorbs some of the slack to start to signal to employers to start hiring in earnest, which will in turn lower unemployment rate and hopefully start putting upward pressure on wages. But the policy questions are important, the policies of offshoring. I mean, do we want policy incentives for companies to get around tax codes when they take jobs off of American soil, or do we want policy measures that give companies incentives to create and to keep jobs here? These definitely are big policy questions.
And it's amazing how the economy has responded so weakly to massive fiscal stimulus and interest rates the lowest they've been in 30 or 50 years, depending upon what interest rate you're looking at.
Yeah, and it's a good thing we had that, because without the housing boom and the refinancing boom, that definitely kept us afloat for quite some time.
So what would be a better set of policies from your point of view?
Well, we think that, you know, fiscal relief to the states would have been good, and even now states like Oregon, that, you know, has like over a 7% unemployment rate. We certainly know that unemployment insurance that we tried to get, that the administration and people in the administration were against passing the extended unemployment benefits, would have been, again, a nice stimulus, because those people need that money and will turn around and spend it right away to pay for everyday necessities. And interesting enough, even now with a 5.4% unemployment rate, we've had 23 months, again, this is unprecedented, 23 months of those who are unemployed, a fifth of them, 20% of those who are unemployed are long-term unemployed. So that goes to tell you that's another kind of statistic we can look at to see how much difficulty there is in the labor market right now. And to have 20% of unemployed be long-term unemployed is really tough. Creates real problem for working families when they run out of their unemployment benefits. Certainly, as I mentioned, targeted tax cuts to lower-income families would probably had been spent better. And but right now, I think we're in a bind.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. And we'll conclude on that dismal note. I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and one of the three authors, along with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein, of their biannual State of Working America, which is issued in preliminary version for Labor Day and will be issued as a real book from Cornell University Press come January. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with this bit of observation about the working life from the Gang of Four.
Sometimes it seems that way.